Now, we spent considerable time last time, last Wednesday night, looking at and considering the cultural background to what we have in chapter 17. We dealt with some of those things, and today, though, we're going to pick up with verse 14 of chapter 17 and look at a particular event that is listed in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. And that is what happens after Jesus and his three disciples came down from the high mountain. And they, as Oswald Chambers would frame it, they left the mountain top and came down to the demon-possessed valley. And both now Mark, again, characteristically of Mark, when you have parallel accounts, he gives you more information, much more than Matthew does here. And Matthew leaves out some vital details, or some details that Mark includes and Luke includes. And we'll kind of touch on some of those, perhaps. So it says, "And when they came down to the multitude, a man came to him, kneeling down to him," and him, of course, is Jesus, "and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an..." And in my translation here, as a lot of English translations render it, have the word, "he is an epileptic." Now, that is a guess. We really don't know what it's the physical ailment part, what it actually was. Literally, it was he was moonstruck. Sometimes a kind of a coarse word that's used that's kind of fallen out of usage is lunatic. Loon, you know, like lunar, has to do with the moon. But moonstruck is the actual word that is used there, or the meaning of the word. So it's a guesstimation. Now, the later, and you're going to see it here too, but in Mark's gospel, it's much clearer that there's a demonic influence here that's causing this problem for this young man. I think it's Mark that also adds that he was possessed or tormented by a deaf and dumb spirit, indicating that he didn't hear and he couldn't talk either. But Matthew does not deal with that particular thing. Anyway, the man meets Jesus, kneels down before him, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic," or he's moonstruck, "and he suffers severely, for often falls into the fire and often into the water. So I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." So he's looking for a cure. So maybe even at this point that the man himself does not necessarily realize what exactly is going on. And it's interesting. Now, we assume we're talking about the nine other disciples that were left down at the bottom of the base of the mountain. But there would be, it's not the designated that it's the nine apostles that are left, but it's the disciples, which could number into, a good number of people that were considering themselves disciples. But nevertheless, the nine are there, and they've already been given authority to cast out demons and to heal diseases, back in chapter 10, I believe. So that they have, Jesus already gave that to them. But for some reason, they could not deal with this particular situation. I don't know if it's Luke or if it's Mark that tells us that there's a debate going on. It's pretty tense. Jesus expresses a bit of frustration when he encounters what's going on here. Matthew preserves that for us when he tells them, "Then Jesus answered, O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me." So Jesus is addressing not simply his disciples, not simply the man, but he's talking about everybody. It's like, why can't you understand what is going on right in front of you? Why are you still in the dark, so to speak? So there seems to be a bit of frustration there. And Jesus rebuked the demon. It came out of him. And the child was cured from that very hour. Okay? So, Jesus has no problem with it. Doesn't say he calls it by name. He does not even inquire its name. We don't have a rebuke that's listed here other than Jesus has simply rebuked the demon and it came out of him. And the child or the young man was cured from that very hour. Quite a contrast to what the disciples could not do. Jesus easily did. Okay? And all this plays together with that historical background that we talked about last time. Here Jesus comes down from the mountain, a high mountain, and breaking from where the traditional mountain of Transfiguration is, Mount Tabor, but in Mount Hermon itself, when he comes down from there, he's still in that same kind of territory, that Bashan territory that was considered to be under the dominion of the devil. Remember, that's where the gates of hell is located. Remember, at Caesarea Philippi, which is part of that region. So the first thing that happens is he has a demonic encounter. Now, it's good for us to kind of once in a while begin asking some questions, trying to understand what exactly is happening here. Some would argue, and this is not my position by any means, but some would argue that what was happening here was a physical ailment that because of the primitive people of that day and a superstition that they just attach it to believe that it was a demon in origin that was causing this. Well, I have a difficulty with such an explanation simply based on this. I don't think the Bible is going to give us misleading information. Jesus wasn't culturally appropriating the beliefs of the people of the time. He was dealing with something that was genuine and real. So let's just deal with this for just a moment. Even though this particular ailment, whatever this young man was experiencing, whether it was epilepsy or some other kind of problem, has as its source, or a portion of its source, somehow involved in the process, a demon. A demon. Now, sometimes demons are called unclean spirits, and sometimes simply demons. I think the King James Version sometimes will render the word for demon as devils. It's not exactly correct. There's one devil. There may be, you know, hundreds of thousands maybe of demons, but this one devil. But anyway, Jesus has no problem with this particular demonic spirit. They submit to him. The interesting thing is going to be the question that comes next from his disciples. How come we couldn't do it? He's already given them the authority to do it. He gave them God will remove, you know, will cast them out through their word. So what's the problem, men? What's wrong here? Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. Then the disciples came, verse 19, came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And then Jesus moves to a somewhat of a surprising position here, or subject matter. He points out, "It because of your unbelief. For assuredly I say to you, if you had the faith of a mustard seed, you could say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it would move, and nothing would be impossible for you." So he shifts from, well, the issue is faith. Now, you're welcome to participate. What exactly is faith? If I just stepped off a spaceship from somewhere out in the cosmos somewhere, and I came and I stepped out and I said, and I read the word faith and I ask you, what's faith? What would you say? There's several ways we can go with that because it depends on the context, like almost every other word. It depends on the context. Oh, you're of the Christian faith. We hear that, don't you? Or sometimes it stands for the place of denomination. Well, you're the Baptist faith, you're the Pentecostal faith, you're the Presbyterian faith. We use it in those kind of contexts. The Bible is really not using it like that. It's using it in a different way. So exactly how is it using it? What does it mean? Well, the NIV will occasionally translate the word pistis, or, you know, we're getting the word faith from, as trust. Sometimes they do that with believe. Believe is another one of those slippery English words that we don't know exactly what it means, at least not biblically. So faith can fall in that kind of category too. Faith is active. Many times it's a verb. Faith, trust, is a pretty good rendering for our purposes. It is something we trust. We trust in God. We trust in what He has revealed. That's what it means to be faith. It does have faith. It does mean believe. There has to be belief attached to it. You don't have faith in what you don't believe. You know. That's important. I've told you this story before, that this is a true story. I have the guy's name written down. I just don't remember it offhand. But what he was doing was going across the Niagara Falls. He was a tightrope walker. And there was one little boy that was very enthusiastic about this guy's ability to walk on a tightrope across such a dangerous area. And he even came to the point of asking the question of the crowd. And that enthusiastic little boy was right there. Do you believe that I could push a wheelbarrow across it? Oh, yes. He was just all beside himself. Oh, yeah. He was just all excited. He said, you think I could push a man in a wheelbarrow across this? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Little fellow did. And the little fellow, I guess, was so enthusiastic, he caught the guy's attention. He said, okay, young man, come here. That little boy just disappeared. Now, he was very enthusiastic about what he thought this guy could do. But did he really have faith in what that guy could do? No. Not really. You can illustrate it a lot of different ways. Sometimes we use things like that help kids understand about a chair. I saw when you all came in here, I didn't see anyone come up to the chair, examine it, look at it, to see if it would support your weight. Why did you not do that? You just believed that chair will hold you, didn't you? You didn't even give it a second thought. Now you've got it a second thought, but before you didn't give it a second thought. Just what you could. We use that sometimes. It's not a very good illustration, but it kind of helps to some degree. To some degree. Years ago, there was Eugene Nida. You may not recognize the name, but he was a very important figure for the American Bible Society for a number of years. He was involved in Bible translation. And he came to Midwestern Seminary while I was a student there, and he was speaking in a week of lectures, Sizemore lectures or something. And Dr. Nida was talking about the challenges of Bible translation, especially to people groups that don't have a written language. They have an oral language, obviously, but it's not written down. So one of the things they have to do first, of course, is they have to come up with an alphabet and then be able to build words and sentences and all that kind of stuff and syntax of sentences and statements. And one of the things that they noticed was, one Bible translator somewhere found, he was working with a group of people, he got the language. You know, he had a tape recorder and had them talk into it, and he did all that. So he had an alphabet constructed. He had words constructed and all that kind of thing, building on punctuation and whatnot, and began trying to teach people. But he ran into a problem. They had no word for faith in that language. At least he couldn't find one. And so he was really, you know, the translator was very, very troubled. What do I do? How do I translate the New Testament into a language that has no word for faith? So, as many Bible translators have found, there's that period of of almost exasperation. You don't know what to do. And then he said there was one of the boys that he was working with, you know, early teens, about 10 or 12 years old, said he was out playing, he was running, and he came into the area of the little hut that this Bible translator was living in, and there was a chair there, and he flopped down in that chair and said, you know, oh, I'm so grateful this chair can support all my weight. Bingo! He had a word, not a word, but a phrase to indicate faith. And there's a lot of other very interesting stories that Dr. Knight had told that time when he was there that week about the challenge of Bible translation. But even in English, even though we understand the language, there are times that we kind of lose the concept of what actually a Bible passage is talking about. Faith and belief is one of those. The reason why we struggle so much is we don't think like Hebrews. We think like Greeks. We think in the abstract. Now, I am not saying that the Hebrews did not think deep thoughts, but they thought in metaphor, pictures, word pictures. That's why you look in the Old Testament. Can you find one verse in the Old Testament says that God is all-powerful? You will see Him called the Almighty, El Shaddai. You will have God Almighty. You will find a lot of things, but most of the time what you'll find is God is my rock. God is my fortress. The Lord is my shepherd. You see? They would speak in metaphor. That's how the image they would think. But Greeks don't think that way. Greeks don't think in metaphor or pictures, they think in abstracts. Have you ever read some of the some of the things that, like Socrates or Aristotle or some of the other Greek philosophers, some of the stuff they would talk about? It's abstract. You know, talk about chairness, and this is just there must be a perfect chair out there somewhere. You know, just different things like that. So we struggle because that's the way we think. So here's where I'm going with all this. When we come across the word believe or faith, the likelihood of us adequately, biblically understanding it is somewhat challenged. Because what we're going to think when I say all you've got to do is believe. You preachers say that? Do you know what people are hearing? All I have to do is agree with what you're saying. All I've got to do is agree with what you're saying, and that's okay. That's not what the Bible is talking about. That's why James is quite clear. Faith without works is dead. You know, he's from the Show Me State. He's from Missouri. If you show me your faith without works, I'll show you my faith by my works. So belief and faith is active. It's a verb, not a noun, and it's not simply an intellectual agreement with a state of a group of propositions been stated. Any more than a little boy believed that a tightrope walker could push him in a wheelbarrow across the Niagara Falls. We don't get that because that's the way our culture thinks. That's how we've been trained to think. If you want, and again, I don't mean it childish. I just mean childlike in the sense. When you say things to children, you need to be aware that they take your words literally. I was carrying a niece. I mean, this was before Tara and I even got married. I was carrying her on my shoulders. Was going to the spaghetti factory, you know, in, down by the arch. And I'm walking, here's the edge of the road, I'm walking here, and there is a sign right there. Now, she's about three, maybe three and a half, something like that, I don't know. It's summertime, so she'd be about three and a half. There's a sign there, and I tell her, watch the sign. Now, you Greek thinkers know exactly what I meant. I meant, you've got to be careful, there's a sign right there, you don't want to bang your head on it. we walked by it, and she literally leaned over in my ear and said, "Why? What's it going to do?" That's it. So to kind of put a finer point on it, we'll move on. When we talk about from biblically, if you have saving faith, it's evident. It impacts how you live. It has to. If you have intellectual agreement, it does not have to affect how you live. That's why James also says, you believe that there's one God, you do well. The demons believe and shudder. They tremble. So what do you have over a demon? The answer is nothing. You follow? So it's more of an action word. And a Hebrew would say, if you believe it, you do it. If you don't do it, you don't believe it. It's that simple. All right. So there is a verse that I'm reading from the New King James Version. It includes that if you have the NIV or if you have ESV or you have, if it's a New American Standard, it's bracketed, because this verse that concludes this paragraph is missing in some of what's considered the oldest manuscripts. All right? And what it says is this, it's verse 21. However, this kind does not come out except by prayer and fasting. This kind does not come out except by prayer and fasting. Now, just because it's absent in some of the older manuscript traditions does not necessarily follow that it has been a later addition. It's really that we don't know for certain. And the whole idea, this is called biblical criticism, the whole idea of this is really challenging in a lot of respects, and it's way above my pay grade, so I'll just tell you that right now. But there are scholars that study all of these manuscripts, and they look and compare them and whatnot. And so in some of the earlier manuscripts that most consider to be more closer to the original, this verse is absent. But this verse concludes the question. You see, the question is, why could not we do this? Why were we unable to cast this demon out? Verse 21 answers that question. Because this kind does not go out except by prayer. Now some say it does not go out except by prayer. And there are those others that say prayer and fasting.
What kind was he talking about here?
Talking about the kind of demon that was responsible for this boy's ailment. Because see, that's what they ask in verse 19. The disciples came to Jesus privately and said to him, "Why could we not cast it out?" And Jesus, in verse 20, talks about faith. If you had faith just as much as a mustard seed. But then verse 21, if it is authentic, says simply that it's completing the answer. Now, those that study this kind of thing, some would argue that, you know what? A later scribe noticed the same thing I just said. Jesus did not answer it fully. They ask, why not? He talks about faith. And then some, maybe later, there was a scribe that added this in order to complete the question, or answer the question. I don't know that, nor does anyone else know that. So you have to kind of deal with that. However, when you see the modern translations especially, you have to kind of deal with that. And one of my teachers did take courses in biblical criticism, not criticizing the Bible, but looking very carefully at manuscripts. And he told some things that were quite funny. There were two ways, predominant ways, that we had manuscripts developed. Okay? One would be, if you're a business person, you're a Christian, and you live in Ephesus and you travel to Rome, and when you get to Rome, you find out they have a letter of Paul called Romans. We don't have that. So while you're there doing your business, you, as probably as quickly as you can, you get ink, you get parchment, or you get papyri, and you copy it. Now, when you do that real rapidly, you'll discover that you're gonna mess up things. And especially when you realize there's no space between words. And originally, all of the letters were in capitals. Capital letters. They weren't lowercase. They were all capitals. You can see why, if you ever try something like that, and you're doing it pretty fast, you can see how you might miss a letter, or you might add a letter, or you might, your eye may drop a line or above a line, and you know. So you see some of those kind of differences. Others were professional scribes. Now, professional scribes, they weren't haphazard. They would count letters. And they went slowly. And if they've got a document there, a letter, or whatever they're doing, because they're professionally trained, they are very careful to duplicate it exactly as it is there. All right? If they mess up, it's very expensive to do this, they start over. There's no delete. And, you know, kind of like the old typewriters from yesteryear. You know, you mess it up. Okay. Sometimes scribes would do this. I would, you know, for example, I have six scribes. So, and we're duplicating. We're going to have six copies of the copy that I have. So I am reading it, and each one of the scribes is writing what I read. Okay? Now, there's no standard spelling. They don't have it. The Webster's Dictionary's not made it yet. So there's no standard spelling. So they spell what they hear. But they're trained, so they're good at it. My professor that I mentioned a moment ago, with the kind of a somewhat of a funny thing that he found, is in one of those manuscripts that they were looking at, actually he was looking at a facsimile of the manuscript, a scribe literally had written in the margin, so a fellow scribe next to him could see it. He wrote, "Is it lunch yet?" So sometimes, now, I may probably give you more about the biblical criticism than you really want to know. But there are times that it seems that in some of those ancient copies, a scribe would be writing it down there, and he'd get a thought. And the thought was, he might write it into the margin. Later, another scribe might be copying that copy, and he looks at it and says, "That makes good sense. That seems good." And he kind of brings it to the text. If you want to know where that is, Mark chapter 1. It's a great example. Give me someone with something other than the King James and New King James. Would someone go to Mark chapter 1 and read the first couple of verses? This is like Bible drill. Go. Who's got it? Okay, go ahead.
Now this is CSV. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's probably it.
You don't care what version?
I don't care.
First verse?
Yeah, well, the first couple of verses.
Okay. In Mark, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet.
Bingo. Stop. That's what I want.
Okay.
All right. Now, this may somewhat surprise you. It's nothing to be overly concerned about, because I can't explain it, I think. Now I want you to listen to the New King James. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, as it is written in the prophets. Now, most Bible translators believe that this is a later correction of an earlier manuscript. You know why? Because what is written here in Isaiah is in Malachi. It's not in Isaiah. There is a similar passage, but not this one. So later, a scribe that knows his Bible very well says, well, it's not Isaiah. It's actually, there's something similar in Isaiah, but it's really from Malachi. So instead of reproducing the prophets, Isaiah just wrote the prophets because he thought that made more sense. Now, having said that, there's a case that can be made because of the length of Isaiah that there was kind of a slang way that people refer to prophetic passages, the prophets, because they just say, according to Isaiah, and that meant, that included all the prophets. The 12 minor prophets and the other major prophets, it included all of them. So it's argued, okay? Again, I probably gave you more than you wanted to know, but I wanted to explain verse 21. That there's some question about it, but that question, it's not definitive. We don't really know. Now, let me give you an opportunity to ask questions.
The reason why I asked what I did, so there's more than one kind of demon. Because he's talking about the demon, and I understand that, but it says,
yeah.
But this kind. So how many kinds of different demons are there?
I don't know. I can say this. Jesus says this about the man, it's a parable, but the man who has cleaned up the inside, the house, and said the demon left this man, he goes out, he goes through arid places, and he comes back and he finds that the house is clean, put in order, so the guy is, he's still empty, but he's put in order. So this demon that was once there, he's going to go back to his former host, but he takes with him seven more demons more evil than himself. So yes, there are differences. What those differences are, I don't fully know. We're not told. But yes, there are differences. There actually seems like, and I don't want to carry this too far, there seems to be some sort of hierarchy in the demonic, in the malevolent spiritual world. We don't know. Paul does. Now, I don't think Paul is just wanting to say the same thing three or four different ways. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. We wrestle against principalities and powers and rulers of the darkness in the heavenly places. Oh my goodness, he just nailed down four different statements there. Four descriptive words. But don't go too far in that because we are not given clear information about those things. It says this in Deuteronomy, and later Paul mentions it as well, that those that worship idols are worshiping demons. So when you think about all the different kinds of pagan religions in the world, in the ancient world, even the current world, current day, there can be a whole host of those. I don't know. But if you know, the verse indicates, depending on its authenticity, that there is a kind here. And that's why the disciples were struggling with it. We move on into the next, just two verses. Okay, this is the second time this is going to happen. It's already happened at Caesarea Philippi. It's going to happen again. Now, while they were staying in Galilee, so they're still in the northern part. They're still in the northern part of ancient Israel. Now, while they were still staying in Galilee, the Son of Man, Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is about to be betrayed into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised up. And they were exceedingly sorrowful. And that's it. That's it. This Jesus tells them for a second time what's going to happen. The first time, remember, Peter said, that ain't going to happen. We're not, no. Jesus, again, they're coming back, they're in Galilee. He says, yes, this is what's going to happen. What's going to happen to him? Do you think the disciples fully understood what he's talking about? And the answer, undoubtedly, is no. No. questions or comments you might have. Verse 24. When they had come to Capernaum, those who received the temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" Or the implied is the temple tax. He said, that's Peter, "Yes." And when he had come into the house, Jesus anticipated him, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth take customs or taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" Peter said to him, "From strangers." And Jesus said, "Then the sons are free. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook," not a net, but a hook, "and take the fish that comes up first, and when you have opened its mouth, you will find a piece of money." And that piece of money is going to be the exact amount. "Take that and give it to them for me and for you." It was a particular piece of money that would satisfy the temple tax for both Jesus and Peter. And this raises, now this is nothing more than just a thought, a possibility. It might indicate something about the age of the disciples. Because it was for men that were considered adults were the ones responsible to pay the temple tax. Wherever you lived in the Roman Empire, if you were a Jewish man, considered to be a Jewish man, you were to pay, I don't know how what the age was, I don't know if it was above 20 years of age or 25, I don't know what it was for sure, at least not right this moment, but you were required to pay the temple tax. That temple tax was used in order to keep up the temple and to pay the kind of expenses that were incurred by the temple or the use of the temple and those serving in the temple. So he was required to give that. It's just Peter and Jesus. Now the other guys may have already paid theirs. I don't know. It's not even indicated. But it's interesting that this is left for us to understand that this covered the cost for both Jesus and Peter. Now, if that being the case, perhaps, I'm not saying for sure, perhaps the other disciples were younger than we sometimes imagine them being. That they could have been not yet old enough to be required to pay the temple tax. I don't know that for certain. But I can say this. The Apostle John, at the crucifixion, was probably 15 or 16 years old. Meaning that he was following Jesus at age 12 or 13. Much younger than sometimes we think. Why? Well, one is because of his lifespan. His lifespan goes up to almost 80, 100. Not quite, but up in the middle, in the 90s. So he has a very long, long lifespan compared to, of course, the others were martyrs, died for their faith. Well, regardless of that, but it's interesting what Jesus says there. It could very well be a claim to deity because of how it's framed. In the sense that, Peter's asked about the temple tax. As soon as he walks in the house, Jesus asks him about the temple tax. "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings," now notice that, "the kings of the earth take customs and taxes? From their sons or from strangers?" So if you're the king's son, do you pay taxes? No, you don't. No, you don't. Now, if you're not the king's son, do you pay taxes? Uh-huh. Because he goes in further and points that and makes that statement. He said, and Peter said to him, from strangers, and Jesus said, then the sons are free. That could be just an allusion to Jesus' claim to be deity, implying he is not obligated to pay the temple tax. I get that from what he says next. You see that? Look at next. Nevertheless, lest we offend them, go to the sea, cast in a hook, and take a fish that comes up first, and when you have opened its mouth, you'll find a piece of money, and take it and give it to them for you and for me. Okay? Following up, so we won't offend them, go do this. But it's implied that Jesus does not need to do this, right? He's doing this not because he is commanded to, but because he doesn't want to push the point with those that are collecting the temple tax. Make sense to you, to some degree? Okay.
Would this be another miracle of Jesus?
You know, I've not been a great fisherman, but I've never found money in a fish. I never have seen that. So yes, it's miraculous. He's telling you, now keep catching fish until you find the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, first one. Open his mouth and look what's in there. It's a statum. A piece of money that will pay the temple tax for both of them. Yeah. And so is it a miracle? I started to put it in that category. Yes.
Do you think back up in verse 20 where he's talking about faith and having faith as small as a mustard seed to move them out, do you think that verse causes a lot of
I think a lot of people are confused by it because I honestly don't know anyone that takes that verse so literally they expect a mountain to move. So I think it's a Hebrew metaphor talking about just the smallest amount of faith can God can do a great deal, which is the smallest amount of faith. There's a story about a woman that heard her pastor preach from this passage, and she was somewhat stirred by it, and she went home to her home, and outside her kitchen window, there was, in the distance, there was a mountain, and she could see it from her kitchen window, and she pulled the curtains, went to bed, it was kind of getting late, and she prayed for that mountain to be moved. So she got up early the next morning, just as the sun was coming up. She goes to her kitchen window, she takes the curtains and she pulls them back, and she looks, she says, just like I thought, it's still there. I really don't know anybody. I do understand, if you look at it from a figure of speech perspective, you can see what Jesus is saying. He's saying even the smallest amount of faith, trust in God can result in great things. Literally move a mountain? I don't think there's ever been anybody that's ever done move a mountain. You know. So I think sometimes our trouble is not necessarily with what Jesus says, but our attempts to understand what Jesus says. And there's a lot of reasons for that, because like it or not, no one in this room comes to the Bible with a blank slate. You bring with you a lot of other stuff. You don't even realize you're bringing that other stuff along with you. So when you come and you look at a passage, you've got all that other stuff also informing how you understand that. I remember, I've seen people do this, preach some preachers use a preach from a passage like, oh, they, you know, talking about, you know, don't try to get a speck out of your brother's eye when you've got a, you know, a log in your own eye, and he's growl at that, you know, and preach and pound the pulpit and whatnot. Why do they do that? Well, they do that because they've already come to that passage with their bag of stuff they're carrying with them. Or when they go to the passage talking about the like the Pharisees, Jesus says they strain in a gnat and swallow a camel. Or here's a good one about the about the narrow gate that you have to go through this gate anyway. And they look at those passages, and the thing they struggle with so much on those things is the stuff you bring with you. So let's go back to a couple passages. If we were Jews of that time period, in the first century, and we were listening to Jesus, and he said, no, don't try to get that mote or that piece of sawdust out of your brother's eye, and when you've got a log in your own, the place cracks up. It's a joke. It's understood. It's humor. Hebrew humor is exaggeration. Is he literally talking about a guy with a telephone pole sticking out of his eye? No. They understood it. It's humorous. Strain a gnat and swallow a camel? That was funny. And we look at it so serious because we're not part of that culture. So we struggle with that. And can you picture that in your mind? Have you ever on a summer night opened your mouth, sucked in a bug? Ever done that?
No.
I have more than I would even care to get into it, because we used to ride in the back of a pickup, you know, standing up on the stock racks, and June bugs and everything else would whack us, and you're gonna get bugs in your mouth. Unless you keep your mouth really tight. But anyway, you can hack and you know the natural reaction is try to get that booger out of there as fast as you can. And you just grunt and grunt. Okay, then picture that. And then picture a Pharisee or there's a man swallowing a camel, two humps and all. Low down. Is that not funny? Even for us it's funny. And it was funny for them, for the people that day. And Jesus would say a lot of things that to us we take deadly serious because that's the baggage we bring with us to do it. We all got it. And we don't realize, no, it's not like what we constructed. And this is one of those. It's one of those very challenging statements that if we take it woodenly, we're really bothered by it because we realize, I don't have that. I just don't have that. And I have a feeling you don't either. Not like that. But maybe that's not the point that Jesus is trying to make. Now when we get into chapter 18, this opens up. We remember what we're doing here. If we're walking along with Jesus and his disciples, we are going toward Jerusalem. That's where we're going. He's already told us twice what's going to happen when we get there. So as we're moving that direction, the disciples now, it's down to not the masses. We're done with the multitudes and the crowds. What we're dealing with now is here's the disciples. At least there's going to be more than the 12, but specifically the 12 he's going to be investing in and dealing with as he moves closer and closer to Jerusalem. So when we get into chapter 18, and we will get into that next time, we get into the area of, okay, and this is somewhat of the irony of it. Jesus has told his disciples twice, we're going to Jerusalem, we'll be betrayed in the hands of sinful men, they're going to kill me, and the third day I'm going to arise. So that should be an indication that maybe he's not going to Jerusalem to sit on David's throne. But the first five verses of chapter 18 indicate they still don't get it. They're trying to figure out, and how am I going to get to the most powerful place in His kingdom? I mean, He can walk on water. He can run. He can defeat any demon that He comes across. He can heal any disease. He can feed the multitudes. He can do anything and everything. So He's going for the throne. So where can I position myself in His administration? I want to be at the very top. I want the best I can get. So here come. Now, I know we have a lot of affection for John. But he's not called a son of thunder for no reason. Even if he is 12 or 13 years of age. He's jockeying for one of those positions. Who's going to be the closest to Jesus when he's on his throne? And the other disciples get really ticked off at them because they probably didn't think of it first. It's kind of like, this is a very inferior example, but I don't know if you ever did this when you were growing up years, but we always did this. We get ready to go in a car somewhere. Shotgun. You know what that is?
Yeah.
One time, two of my buddies, myself and my basketball coach, we went to the state finals just to watch the games. And we watched the games there, and we saw some really good players and great teams. And we were just, everybody was just kind of so excited when the game was over. We was going to drive back. It's going to be about a four-hour drive back to back to the school that we went to. And everybody was so excited, and suddenly it dawned on me. Nobody said it yet. So I yelled out, "Shotgun!" And the other two guys just groaned. And I'll tell you why. Because our coach had a Camaro.
Oh.
Here we are, every one of us over 6 feet tall, and the back seat of that Camaro is about that wide. No leg room at all. Whoever sits, and those two guys are going to sit back there the whole time. So that's kind of what they're doing. Not exactly, but that's kind of what they're doing. You know, they're trying to say shotgun. They want to get there. They want to get in those positions of the most power. Because they're thinking like human beings, fallen human beings. That's what they want. That's what they want. So we'll get into that next time, chapter 18. And what Jesus begins pointing to is just surprising. And we'll look at that. Last chance for thoughts or questions.
Don't you just think it's interesting that, I mean, Jesus is wanting Peter to of course, to be able to pay that tax. But it's Peter, and he sends him to fish.
Yeah.
He didn't say sell the fish, he didn't win her, but because how many fish has Peter ever caught, and he's opened that, like you said a while ago, and found a coin. So, again, Jesus uses something that's going to really impact him.
And it's not just any coin.
Yeah.
It's the exact coin.
Right.
It's the exact coin that they needed. That's right. Well, thank you for your kind attention. Yes.
One of the things that I've noticed is that Pharisees and hanging around Peter.
They are following, working for something to be
It makes me
Those
this
evening. Yep, same
call. Travel all the way up into the
Oh, that's right. I'm glad you remembered.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Can I ask a question on something else?
My son would be back there.